You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon and good morning, everybody. I'm Camille Bucette at the Brookings Institution. And I wanted to very much welcome you to today's event on how social networks impact economic mobility. I wanted to talk a little bit about why we did this study, and then I will go ahead and introduce my fellow panelists and speakers. Our agenda is basically we'll hear a few remarks from our head researcher. We will also hear a few remarks from our funder at the Gates Foundation. Then we will go over the results of the project. And then from there, we will engage in a spirited discussion with our panelists who represent each of the three cities that we study. So let me start from the very beginning. We all know that economic mobility, that is the ability for a poor child to move up on the economic ladder past where his or her parents have been, is dependent on a number of factors. And when we think about those factors, we usually think about ability to get a good job, ability to get a good education, maybe living in a different neighborhood. One of the things we don't typically study and don't typically think about is how who we know impacts our ability to get a good job, to get a good education, and to maybe live in a better neighborhood. So what we decided to do was really try to understand whether our social relationships, which we are calling social networks here for today, whether they do impact our ability to access opportunity. And one of the reasons that we were very interested in doing this is that when we looked around, there was actually very little data on this. And the reason we wanted to get the data was that policymakers, when they make choices about which policies to pursue that could perhaps increase economic opportunity for a variety of populations, they do that on the basis of data. And when data isn't missing, they just continue on to the places where data actually exists. So it was really important for us to be able to collect the data. And what we wanted to do is we wanted to be able to do a couple of different things in the study. The first was try to compare different areas of the country that have different types of economic mobility profiles. So we selected Racine, Wisconsin, Washington, D.C., and San Francisco, California, all of which have very different mobility profiles. San Francisco has a very high economic mobility profile. Washington, D.C. is in the middle, and Racine, Wisconsin is a little bit more representative of cities that have had some delays in economic mobility and economic development more generally. So what we did was we then recruited people, participants across these three cities who looked like the people who live there, and ask them through 60 to 90 minute interviews some very detailed questions about who they reach out to when they are trying to get information about jobs, about education, and about housing opportunities. And then we ask them about the people that they reached out to. So tell us about the people you reached out to for a job. We want to know, do they look like you? Are they similar in age? Are they similar in gender, similar in income? How strong is that relationship and how reciprocal is that relationship? We collected all that data and we analyzed that, actually statistically, to figure out what the differences were in social networks and if there were any, and then what were some of the more important factors to focus on as we tried to figure out the mobility picture relative to social relationships in these three cities. So what we did was when we did the initial analysis, and Jill will talk a little bit more about this, but we decided that we're going to really focus on a couple of different factors, and she'll describe what those factors are and why we decided on those factors to really better understand economic mobility in these three cities. So with that, I am going to turn things over to COSAR, but before I do that, I want to introduce everybody who has joined us here. And so we'll start with Kosar. Kosar Johani is a program officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Dr. Jill Zimmerman is the deputy director at Econometrica. Dr. Richard Reeves, my colleague here at Brookings, he's a senior fellow in economic studies. Ann Stoldreyer, the director of financial justice at the City and County of San Francisco. Tiffany Williams, the chief program officer at Martha's Table. And Maurice Horton, who's the alderman for the 7th District in Racine. I also just want to say that we had tremendous cooperation from a variety of partners throughout the study. So PolicyLink in Oakland, California was a great partner of ours. Martha's Table here in Racine and Higher Expectations in Racine, Martha's Table in Washington, and Higher Expectations in Racine were phenomenal partners, helped us recruit folks, and were just so helpful as we tried to put together a questionnaire and also just as we went through the study. So big thank you to all of you. So wanted to also thank COSAR and the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation for their tremendous support. They really took a risk on some pretty pioneering research, and we are very, very grateful for that. And so COSAR, I'm gonna turn things over to you.
Thank you, Camille, and hi, everyone. I'm delighted to be here with you today. I imagine if you're tuned in, all right, I think I was muted initially, so I'm going to start over. Hi, everyone. I'm really delighted to be with you here today. I think if you're tuned in here, as Camille mentioned, you're someone who really cares about upward economic mobility in this country and the prospect of every American experiencing that at some point in their lifetime and continuing to experience that. From my vantage point where we sit as funders, there's a lot of really robust data that has helped shape the narrative around economic mobility in this country. I think all of you are probably familiar with the work that Rod Shetty has done through the Opportunity Atlas. And what we learn from projects like that and robust analyses like that is that place and community really matter when it comes to upward mobility, both at a macro level and also a very micro level. So, you know, the region of the country that you or your children grow up in is super important, but so are neighborhoods, so are zones within neighborhoods, and even at the street and block level. So you start to paint a picture of upward mobility in this country, and you realize there is a lot that we know about places. There are observable characteristics like poverty rates within those places, the level of segregation within schools in those communities. But as you dig deeper, and as Camille hinted, there's a lot that we don't know about how upward mobility works in this country because the data is missing. We know from qualitative and observational studies that social capital and social networks are really important, but we don't have a way of objectively measuring and quantifying them. And so you end up both with a really good understanding of what's happening and sort of patterns in the country, but also a black box when it comes to these unobservable characteristics. And that's why this research was so exciting for us in its methodology. And as Camille mentioned, being able to quantify and present all of the stuff that we all know matters in an objective and rigorous way. And matters to outcomes that we really care about, in this case, access to job quality, access to stable housing, access to educational opportunities that really match your life goals and what you're trying to attain in your life. So I'm really excited to hand the ball over to Jill Zimmerman-Lawrence. She's going to talk about how they conducted this research, what it tells us about how we get access to these opportunities and you know, the benefits of using this type of methodology for studying concepts like social capital and social networks. So, Jill, handing it over to you.
Thanks so much, Kosar. Sorry about that. So my name is Jill Zimmerman-Lawrence. I'm a researcher at Econometrica Incorporated, and I'm presenting our research process and some of our methodology on behalf of our team. Our research questions required us to define our participants' social networks, and not in terms of who you hang out with or who you video game with, but in terms of who do people go to, for help and advice and assistance on economic opportunities, such as getting a job, And then we pushed our research even further to determine how these networks differed as the participants differed, as their demographics changed. So originally we had planned to do in-person interviews in each of our three cities of San Francisco, California, Racine, Wisconsin, and Washington, DC. But due to COVID-19, we had to adjust our interview guide and our process to be 60 to 90 minute telephone and video-based interviews. Each participant did receive $50 through a gift card for participating. We had the largest recruitment responses through Craigslist advertisements, social media blast, and assistance from individuals in our local communities, including our nonprofit partners, our community ambassadors, and participants that recruited on our behalf. Community ambassadors were really important for recruiting in the Latino communities. We interviewed a total of 262 people, but our final analytics sample is 254 participants. You can see here a little bit about the gender, race, ethnicity, and incomes of our final participants. So to solicit information on who was in a participant's social network, like Camille referenced, we asked them a series of questions on each of our research topics. Our research topics are on the left side of the screen with the icons beside them. We started each topic with the question, thinking back to the last time you were seeking advice regarding jobs, how many times or who did you reach out to for advice? We asked them to name up to five of the people that they reached out to, and then we collected demographic information from the participant on each person in their social network. And then we also identified what type of help they received from their network. Maybe they just got advice, or maybe they got a down payment on a house, assistance with that kind of thing. We also asked other contextual questions about the person's community and experience, such as, what are the strengths of your community? And what kind of factors, such as age, contribute to challenges you face in life? We took the participants' responses and constructed their social networks. You're seeing an example of a 30-year-old Black male's social network for jobs, housing, and education. We analyzed each person's social network for their size and for how homogeneous or heterogeneous the people in the network are compared to the participant. This participant reached out to a total of six people, and 50% of the network is Black, and like the participant, and then 50% is also male, like the participant. When we look further into the network, we see that the participant reached out to five people for jobs. Those are the little green symbols. Two for education, we'll see the pink school icon, and one for housing, as indicated by the orange house icon. Once we constructed the social networks for participants, we began looking at our data and our findings through different lenses. We asked, how do these trends in the data change when we group participants based on the participant's race? What about when we group the findings based on the age of the participant, and so on? We began to see some patterns, but really felt like it was not telling the whole story. So we further evolved our research and took an innovative approach of combining lenses. We asked, how do these trends change when we consider two demographic characteristics, for instance, race and gender? And the city-specific trends really became more pronounced. We found that in Washington, D.C. and Racine, Wisconsin, trends were most pronounced when we considered race and gender together. And in San Francisco, trends were most pronounced when we considered race and income. So I find I loved this research and really thought the findings were innovative and fascinating. A few findings or trends that I thought were interesting are that many people really qualified that their social networks did not provide them an unfair advantage. You see a short quote here. Others indicated that they were self-reliant, preferred to conduct internet research instead of relying on their social networks. These two themes really made me think of the value that American society puts on an individual's ability to pick themselves up by their own bootstraps instead of celebrating the gift of community support. Finally, this research reinforced some assumptions that I had. White men had the most racially homogenous networks, meaning their networks were mainly white. And women generally asked for help from other women, where men, especially white men, had men and women in their networks. I'm now going to turn it over to Camille and Richard to talk further about our findings.
Great. Thanks, Jill, for that overview. So what I wanted to do here is just remind you that what we're asking is, how do social networks, how are they related to economic mobility, and who do people reach out to for access to jobs, education, and housing? Those are the three topic areas. So I'm going to just dive into the main findings. So I think the most important finding, as Jill already alluded to, was that race turned out to be the most important and consistent differentiator of social networks relative to jobs, education, and housing. Across all three cities, white participants had the most racially homogenous networks relative to jobs, education, and housing. In Washington, networks were fairly racially homogenous for all groups except Latina females, and were most racially homogenous for white men in Washington, D.C. In Racine, whites had more racially homogenous networks than blacks, with white males having the most racially homogenous networks once again. Among the three cities, San Francisco stands out as having the least racially homogenous social networks. Although whites in San Francisco are more likely to have the most racially homogenous social networks than are other racial groups. In San Francisco, homogeneity differed by each topic, but it was generally lower than what we saw in Washington, D.C. and Racine. Overall, whites of both incomes, this is again in San Francisco, below $50,000 and $50,000 and above annually in individual income, and Asians with incomes of $50,000 and greater had more racially homogenous networks than other groups. Latinos with incomes of $50,000 and greater had less homogenous networks than other groups, though the sample size in our sample was rather small. Richard, I'm going to turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Camille. Let me add my thanks to all the participants in this study, and also to one of our colleagues within Brookings, Sarah Unzau, who's been a key part of the team bringing all this work together. A couple of just framing points, really to underline what's already been said from an economic mobility perspective. I think of social networks as almost like a subterranean factor, very difficult to see on the surface, very hard for social scientists to get at, hard to get at through quantitative data, but hugely influential in terms of prospects for economic mobility. You can think of social networks in some ways as like the soft tissue of inequality. You know, we know about hard institutions like schools and jobs and so on. They're easy to measure, but this kind of soft tissue, the connective tissue, turns out in many cases to be just as important. I think what that does is it underlines the point that's already been made, which is this question of relational equality. And the connection between relational equality or inequality and resource inequality, and how one kind of reinforces the other. And I think as Kotar kind of pointed out, even with the best quantitative data in the world, i.e. all of the IRS data that Raj and his team have at Opportunity Insights, you can only go so far. And then in order to go further, you have to really dig in the way that this work does. So just picking up on the main findings, I think one of the real standouts for us is that the social networks of Black men are really very truncated for jobs, education, and housing. Smaller, truncated, and very homogenous. And so this kind of segregation of relationships and networks is particularly strong for Black men. That's where you see it the strongest. And Black men will say that's because of access to income and jobs, as well as their own race, as a factor getting in the way of being able to build these networks. In all the cities that we looked at, people cited friends, family, and colleagues as the kind of key nodes in the network, and old colleagues, especially in job networks. But friends and family accounted for about half of most people's, the average person's given social network. So again, this issue of kind of community and friends and family being kind of a hugely important part of the story. And then there's this central question of how these networks are formed. We also asked how are the networks formed, where and how are they formed? And what we found was that they're primarily formed through work education settings, and then to a somewhat lesser extent through community activities, although interestingly in San Francisco, community activities did seem to account for a greater share of this network creation work that we were also able to identify. But crucially, through these institutions of work and education, and that of course then has huge relationships to the resources that people are able to gather. And so again, relational inequality leading to resource inequality, which in turn leads to relational inequality, because if you're excluded from the institutions where networks, particularly networks that will get access to resources are formed, then you are excluded from those resources. So really, this issue of relationships and resources are kind of two sides of the same coin. There was some variation in the size of the social networks in the cities. Racine actually had two larger size of networks, whereas Washington and San Francisco is slightly smaller, about 5 people in the latter two and 6 in the former. So I think that tells us there is some variation, but also it's going to really matter what those relationships are and how effective they are in kind of moving forward. So just a couple of points on DC specifically, then I'll hand back to Camille to pick up with Racine. DC really kind of underlined this point about racial homogeneity that has already been kind of mentioned, and especially so for white men. So it's all very, very racially homogenous networks in Washington, DC, and especially white men. In fact, of the people that white men reach out to for support, 97% are white. So it is very rare for a white man to be getting network support through someone other than who is white. And for whites, actually, it's slightly the largest proportion of the networks with friends. And so you're getting to this kind of a broader set of kind of weaker social ties, but also hugely important. White participants, again, hugely institutionally formed, school, college, and work. And black men, once again, having small networks, especially around housing in DC. So in DC specifically, it's just important to note that this is where kind of resource and relational inequality overlap and intersect with each other. Is that, you know, 92% of white and Asian students graduate high school in DC, 64% of black, and 57% of Hispanic. And so what you're seeing is that those are not staying in the institutions where the networks are formed, which means they're not getting important educational credentials, which are the access keys to other institutions, which again will form relationships. So you're seeing this sort of the circularity, both positively and negatively, for these institutions, and very low rates of employment for black residents in DC, which is both a reflection and a cause of this relational inequality that we see. And then, of course, an obvious point one has to be made is that DC is a highly residentially segregated city by race, and that obviously, again, both reflects and reinforces these network inequalities that we've seen across all the cities. With that, I'll hand back to Camille.
Great. Thanks, Richard. Continuing, we want to talk a little bit about Racine in San Francisco. I'll talk say a few words about the Racine results first. So what we found in Racine was that white participants in our project have larger job networks than blacks. Again, we've seen this in other places. We saw this in Washington, D.C. White respondents were more likely than black respondents to meet non-family job network members through school, again, very similar to what we saw in Washington, D.C. White participants met a greater proportion of their education network members at work than black participants. Again, underscoring the importance of the educational setting and the employment setting as important places to build these social networks. More black participants in Racine had service providers, such as realtors or city employees in their housing network. And race was a factor, was considered a challenging factor for 100% of the black men that we interviewed, and only for 14% of white women that we interviewed. So on two very different ends of that scale. And then we also found that money was a pretty challenging factor for just about everybody at the same rate in Racine, which I think speaks to the general position of Racine and where it finds itself in terms of economic development. Just to contextualize those results just a little bit more, we know that school and work are very important to forming social networks. The school climate, however, in Racine generally is not conducive to doing that, particularly for black students. So in 2019, for example, black students were 6 times more likely to be suspended than white students for similar kinds of incidents. We also know that the unemployment rate for black residents in Racine was 11.6% in 2018 compared to 5.6% for white residents, so roughly double. Again, out of the workforce, not really able to form those relationships in the workplace. We also know that Black men are disproportionately incarcerated in Racine County as the second highest incarceration rate for Black residents in the country. Again, another element that will pull particularly Black men out of a number of settings in which you could form social relationships. Now I want to move on to San Francisco. So the job network size among our participants in San Francisco tended to be larger for those who had higher income. So that was 50,000 or more per year, and was also higher for Asian respondents. Greater proportions of participants in San Francisco with incomes of higher incomes met their education network members, non-familial education members, through work than those who had lower income. So education network for higher income folks was at work, education network for low income folks was not at work. Respondents with incomes that were less than 50,000 were more likely to have service providers such as a social worker or a case manager in their housing network. And that makes sense, particularly given the high cost of housing in San Francisco. Community activities were very important for social network formation, more so than in Washington, D.C. or Racine, and that was especially true for low-income residents in San Francisco. We also found that Latinos earning less than $50,000 cited age, race, immigrant status, and national origin as challenges to finding opportunities. And so again, it's pretty clear that low-income Latinos have a hard time integrating in San Francisco, and their social networks tend to be smaller and also much more stressed. And they tend to encounter far more challenges in finding opportunity than other folks in San Francisco. I want to contextualize those results a bit. San Francisco is a very racially diverse city with sizable white, Asian, and Latino populations. The city does, however, have some pockets of segregation. The median income in San Francisco for San Francisco households is $112,000, but income inequality as measured by the Gini index is higher than the national average. So it's a huge, very wealthy population, and then we have a very large kind of very low income population in San Francisco. And then again, a recent study found that San Francisco was the most intensely gentrified city in the country from 2013 to 2017, and that has continued up until the COVID moment. So with that, we are going to move into our panel mode. I'm going to turn things over to Richard.
Thanks, Camille. Camille's staying on to run a panel as well as the other three panelists who Camille introduced earlier. Thank you all so much for joining. It's interesting, the work of Alan Barubi, one of our colleagues, shows that the middle class has really shrunk in places like San Francisco. So you are things kind of hollowing out, which I think is also, something that we see echoed in this research here. So we're going to go to some folks who are sort of dealing with many of the issues that are outlined in this report just day to day in terms of the work you're doing. So thank you not only for joining us today, but also for the work that you're all doing to try and promote economic mobility and justice in the various ways in which you're all doing that. So I'm just going to invite each of you to kind of reflect on kind of what you've heard so far from this report, what resonates, what you think is missing, what seems to feel right to you, and how that interacts with the work that you're already doing to try and kind of create more opportunity and more economic mobility. So Maurice, would you mind kind of kicking us off and giving a sense of kind of what was your reaction? Does that sound right to you? And how does it fit with the work you're doing? Describe that for us a little bit, please.
Thank you guys for having me. I'm glad that that the data was collected. It sounds right for Racine. We have a lot of issues here that we are working on. I must say that, just even with our education, like some of the study talked about, Blacks are being suspended, more likely than whites for pretty much the same infraction in school. I worked in the school district here for about 20 years. I was actually doing some mentoring programs, and a lot of that is true. And so we tried to find ways to, do a lot of mentorship with the youth, because one thing I think, I won't say the school did not know, but, you know, a lot of kids that are coming to the schools come from the inner city, a lot of trauma within those communities and neighborhoods, which affect them when they come to school, you know, daily. And so even, you know, even as we go as far as gunshots in the neighborhood or someone's arrested last night, 2-3 in the morning because of a drug raid. And so a lot of times when they come to school, you know, their emotional things have happened. And we have to start taking a look at that, which causes them to act out and more likely be suspended.
Yeah, I think that's a really important way of kind of connecting these two issues of how relationships in the community, the strength of networks in the community affect the ability to learn, right, in an institution. And actually, individuals don't sort of operate like units of human capital to be slotted into schools and learn, right? They're human beings who are affected by things that are happening around them. All the time. So that's a great way to kick us off. Great. And do you want to just weigh in with your thoughts from out there in terms of, did this feel right to you in terms of what you're seeing, these inequalities you saw, and how does it relate to the work that you're doing?
Yeah, sure. Thank you so much for having me. So much in this study resonated with me, and it really just made me think more about what we need to be doing more of, you know, in our city. It made me think back to a meeting I was facilitating actually a few months ago. It was focused on criminal justice reform. We had a lot of city folks, a lot of community folks. And, you know, as we do on a lot of these Zoom calls these days, you know, there was an icebreaker question that I put out there, which was, what was your first job? And everybody started talking about their first summer job. And, you know, mine was I was a salad bar attendant at a grocery store. And I got that job because my neighbor's stepfather managed the grocery store. And, you know, people were going around and, you know, this one young man said, you know, who was formerly incarcerated and who grew up in Bayview Hunters Point, you know, said, gosh, like, it's so interesting listening to all of you because I didn't have a summer job. Like, I didn't know how to get one. No one in my community had one. And it really made me think about the importance. When our mayor, London Breed, first started, the first thing she announced in her inauguration speech was something called San Francisco Opportunities for All. And she wanted every high school student in San Francisco to have access to a paid internship or summer job. And she was reflecting on how when she grew up in San Francisco public housing, and she's a Black woman, she got an internship at a community organization, and just how that, you know, completely opened up her world. And she wanted everyone, every young person in our city to have access to that. It made me think about a program we started many years ago called Kindergarten to College, to provide a college savings account to every kindergartner in our city and seed it with an initial deposit. We were really moved by research that showed that if a child had some savings set aside, they were much more likely to go to college. And we really were looking to do something that would change the odds for young people across our city. I saw this was one of the recommendations at the end of the report. You know, I could go on and on. But again, this just is such a useful resource to think about what we need to do more of in San Francisco to, you know, help foster social and economic mobility.
And can I just ask you one question before coming to Tiffany about that savings program particularly? Because that's a great example. I think the research shows that it's the college saver mentality as much as the actual money that changes the outcomes. It's the sense that, you know, does it also change relationships? You know, if you've got this money that's seeded for you to go to college, is there any evidence you start to then interact with different people, that you think differently about your relationships in terms of college going?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think there is research that shows that this money is like hope in concrete form, and that it, even like a very small amount of money, it's more just that the money, whatever the amount, that there's a little bit, you know, set aside for this purpose. you know, my colleagues who run this program, you know, spend a lot of time taking kids to banks and credit unions, many of whom have never been to one. You know, making sure, you know, in kindergarten across the state that there are like college banners set up so that, you know, from day one, everyone really has kind of a college going mentality. And so we're really just trying to instill that from the beginning.
Yeah, thank you so much. Tiffany, I'd love to hear your responses. I mean, it's common to sort of say that you're at the sharp end of many of these problems, of course, so particularly feeling that perhaps right now, and hoping that you and all your colleagues are safe and well, given the events that we've seen over recent days and weeks. But with that, any kind of thoughts that you had in terms of how it fits with your experience and the experience of those you're working with and what it might mean for your work?
Sure, Richard. Well, first, thank you all for inviting me to sit on this panel. And thank you for your well wishes. It has been a very interesting time in the DC area in the last week. And I will not go down a rabbit hole, but it is actually reflective of the very things that we're talking about right now, about access to mobility and what are the variables that contribute to people being able to move forward and not, both visible barriers and invisible barriers. But my reflections upon the work that was done and just thinking about Washington, DC, similar to my colleagues, there are some similarities. A few things that I think for me that stand out specifically around Washington, D.C. is that for many, many years, D.C. was known as the chocolate city because it was a predominantly African-American city. You had African-Americans that were leading the government, the school systems. There was a huge wave of economic mobility that happened where the Black middle class that now exists in Prince George's County, Maryland, for example, which is right outside of D.C., in many ways, that's how that group was created. And so when you look at the demographics of the city now, there have been a lot of shifts in that. And I think that that contributes to some of what we're seeing now around the access and the social networks and how that plays out. And so whereas D.C., I think at one point had a lot of people who they consider affectionately in D.C. as native Washingtonians, people who grew up here generationally. Now, D.C. is very transient where you have people that are coming and going. And it was reflected in the study, but the concentrations now of people who are at the lower end of the economic spectrum are the people who live in Ward 7 and 8. And so specifically for the work that my organization does, that we do at Martha's Table, we are really looking at what are the ways that we can address all of the social determinants of health to move those levers so that people have the access to move themselves and their families forward and to thrive. And that's really important because quite often people don't even realize that they're in a situation that is preventing them from thriving. And so a lot of the work that we focused on has been around building those social networks, bringing people together, connecting people to resources. To be quite honest, in DC, helping people to realize that the city is actually a lot bigger than the community that you live in. So how do you even move outside of your own neighborhood so that you can access resources that are available in the city? And so when I think about what's happening in DC right now, and specifically what's happened in communities that have been disproportionately affected, especially now with COVID, it is really how do we help people to access the resources that are available, because there are quite a number of resources that are in the city, and how do we help people to retool? And so even when you think about the social networks, the job that you had doesn't exist anymore. So how do you connect people to those new opportunities, to the right people, to the right educational opportunities? Retooling is extremely important as we move forward. How do we help people gain new skills so that they actually can access these new opportunities that are going to present themselves as a result of COVID? And so for me, I think about certainly acknowledging some of the trauma. I think Maurice talked a little bit about it, just the impact of just living in very difficult situations, acknowledging that, but also redirecting attention through access to education, access to training, access to safer environments so that people can move themselves and their families forward. And the last thing that I think that I want to just bring up really quickly is one of the things that I did not see reflected, but just given the proximity of where we work in DC, is that even though things are very difficult for people, people still have an amazing amount of hope that their lives can turn around. And I think that's always an important thing to acknowledge, that yes, people recognize it's very difficult, but they do see a brighter day coming. And so all of this, all of the work that we're all doing, what's reflected in the report, really, to me, provides a roadmap to say that we can help people to be able to move themselves toward economic mobility, that it is absolutely probable and it's absolutely possible by acknowledging the reality of where people are and where people want to move themselves.
I love that thought. I'm just going to give Camille an opportunity to give any reflections and go around, you know, with some other thoughts. But these two, this idea of like the mental geography, almost the horizons and the smallness of people's social world that can be created by many of these barriers is really striking. Camille and I have been doing quite a bit of work in Charlotte recently too. And I had this experience of talking to a young Black woman about, you know, in the south side of Charlotte, about what she felt about downtown, right, the city center, which was all being revitalized. And she said, we don't go there. It's 2 miles away. I mean, it's just like me, it felt like, but to her, it was like, I don't know. So those kind of social worlds point, I think, is kind of huge, huge important. Just a reminder to people, if you have questions, you can use the hashtag HowWeRise on Twitter, or you can email events@brookings.edu. I'm going to take some audience Q&A in just a moment. But Camille, I wanted to give you the opportunity to weigh in on anything you've heard so far, and particularly this last point, maybe about this potential, this kind of the optimism that we see and hope.
Yeah, no, and I think that's, you know, first of all, Anne and Maurice and Tiffany, thank you so much for your views and perspectives here. I think it's actually, I have a couple of thoughts on this. First is that, you know, when we think about people's horizons and broadening that, either through the kindergarten through college program or, you know, telling people that, yes, there's actually something beyond Ward 7 and 8 in D.C., the same thing in Racine, it's like you're getting mentors and people are now understanding that they're, you know, particularly their horizons are larger. I think what I want to make sure the audience gets from this is that the reason people's horizons tend to be small is actually the result of a lot of policy decisions that were made in the past. So a great example of this is obviously, you know, housing segregation, and we see that across the country. Housing segregation, it can be a very strong motivating factor for people to not leave their neighborhood, either because there's very little egress out to someplace else, or because when they do move out of their neighborhood, they are policed and followed and arrested and possibly killed. So there are many, many reasons that people have this mentality, like, you know, this square block area, this community, this is where I live, and I'm not going out of that. And to change that, we actually need to change public policy, because that's likely, that is the direct result of public policy. So that's number one. And then number two, about this kind of roadmap to hopefulness, I love the way Tiffany put that, but it's about connecting people up in ways that they aren't connected now. And I think all of us bear a responsibility to do that in a variety of different ways. You've all talked about a number of different approaches that I think you know, have worked, can work. We just need to redouble our efforts. And we need to have people who really feel accountable for those results as well. I'm gonna stop there, Richard.
Yeah.
I think we can take audience questions.
Well, let's do one more quick round, I think, and then go.
Sorry.
But
okay.
I love that. But I think this institute, I mean, I think institutions like Brookings have to take their responsibility seriously too, which is why we're doing a lot more than we used to, right? What is our role as a network hub? But let's take this idea of kind of optimism and resilience that's come up a little bit too. And obviously there are many sort of policy proposals that we outline here. But Maurice, I'd like to come back to you to just, on the sort of solution side, what have you seen or experience that you feel is most productive in terms of bridging these relational gaps? What do you think is the best way that you've seen or experienced and been involved in terms of building social networks?
Well, I think for Racine, we've started, you know, like right now we have 4 or 5 African-American men and females that sit on the Common Council, probably the most represented in a long, long time. So when funding and government funds are brought to the council, we're looking to get people, one, employed, those that are unemployed. We also have passed a few ordinances saying that the contractors that come into Racine have to have a 20% goal on every project that's $1 million or more within the city. And so we're looking to get what we're looking for those contractors to do is not to come into the city and, you know, get all these finances without hiring people of color and women. So we've really been driving that hard. We also, the program is called the Racine Works Program. And so every contractor, everything that we have going on in the city, the 20% goals are put on it. Not only that, we are building really, really nice apartments here. But also on those apartments, you have to be able, people have to be able to get into those nice apartments, no matter where they live, their income. So instead of building 200 apartments that only for those that earn a certain amount of money, low income is also being accepted in those places too, which are really nice. So why build them and then you cannot get in them? So I think Tiffany said something, you know, she kind of woke me up a little bit to a lot of things that she was saying. And I think that with this data, what I'm going to do, I'm going to take this data that you guys put together and kind of drive it home more with policymakers here in the, on the city and with the county and share this, because we're headed in that direction. I think this is an opportunity for us to say, not just talk about it, but have some data to support us moving in that direction. And so, you know, you guys coming, the incarceration rate, people being incarcerated this disproportionately, especially people of color. You know, I had an opportunity in which, you know, I went to prison, I did time, I came out, but Tiffany said it, being motivated. So now, you know, my credibility in this city is that if he can do it, I can do it. So I share that story with everywhere I go. And so even in outreach, it's not so much of outreach being done, it's who's selling the story, and people trusting that, hey, here's an opportunity for you to get a job. I want you to follow up with me. I'm going to call you. And so we have to take a look at who's doing the outreach here. So I think that the city of Racine, with a lot of programs that it's initiating, like financial literacy, the 509 program for those that don't have a high school diploma, Higher Expectations, who did a lot of work with you guys, combining the two together, I think that we're headed in the right direction. And with the data, it only supports where we need to be going. Yes, there is a lot of work to be done, but I'll say this, it's not that it's not being took in consideration that we need to do this. And so driving it home to policymakers and saying, this is something that we need to continue to do here in the city of Racine.
Thank you, Maurice. And I'm going to throw the same question to you, because one of the things that I think it would be fair to say that reducing segregation in housing and in educational institutions and so on, it's necessary but not sufficient for reducing relational inequality, because as Kosar mentioned, you see you can replicate those relational gaps at a micro level, right, within high schools, right, within neighbors, within apartment buildings. You're seeing this kind of micro segregation too. So it looks like relational inequality can survive even kind of the bringing together of people, right, as you go down. So what have you seen that works, or experience that works, in terms of specifically in building these relationships?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really important question. And I would love to pick up specifically on something Camille said as well, which is how policy can drive, you know, people's opportunity. And unfortunately, policy can also inadvertently limit people's horizons and limit people's opportunities. And in San Francisco, in a lot of the work I'm doing right now, is focused on fines, fees, tickets, financial penalties, and how we have found that unfortunately, many of these have an adverse and disproportionate impact on people with low incomes and communities of color. We started the Financial Justice Project really in response to strong community outcry about the heavy toll these things were taking in community and really how they were limiting people's opportunities to jobs and to housing. So we heard about how, you know, the fact that we were suspending people's driver's licenses when they could not pay their traffic tickets and when they missed traffic court dates. Without a driver's license, it is very hard to get and keep a job. And this was happening to tens of thousands of people in our city. If someone's car got towed, you know, it was several hundred dollars. A lot of people could not afford to get their car back. It made it very hard to get to work. When people got out of jail, we were handing them a bill to pay for thousands of dollars of fees to cover the cost of their incarceration. You know, we heard from, if you've had a loved one who was incarcerated in our jails, if you wanted to talk to that person once a day, it would cost hundreds of dollars a month. You know, these things really create huge barriers. And, you know, there's a way to hold people accountable without putting them in financial distress.
This was like the policies and practices that deliberately aim to destroy relationships in that case, right? And it's almost like the intent of the punishment. It's part of it. So we have some questions coming in. Tiffany, my proposal was to direct these questions to you, but then also invite you to kind of reflect a bit on what you've seen that's working. And a couple of them are quite similar to some of the work you do, I think. So two questions. One is, what's the role of community events and organizations? Right. So can you create community through events or through particular kinds of organization? I thought of you when I was reading that one. And another one, if anyone's interested in it, is, and Jill's joined the panel too, so if people have questions for her, is what role for kind of arts and cultural organizations, which I'm interested in. I don't know if people have views on that too, but Tiffany, what kind of works, and what about this question either of kind of community organizations and events? Do they work in terms of building sustainable relationships in your experience?
So I actually think that community organizations are actually extremely important in building those social networks. Part of what Maurice talked about is the notion of credibility. And so until I trust you, you can offer me the moon. But if I don't trust you and if I don't have a relationship with you, I'm not going to receive any of the information you have for me, even if it is great information for me. So I think it's extremely important to have community organizations and community events that bring people together, that celebrate the strengths within communities, and then connect people to access, to be able to access resources and services. So you had mentioned relational inequality. There are two sides to that, right? So there's something to be said about having a community where people understand your story and they can relate to your story and they can reinforce and strengthen who you are as a person in a positive way, and also connect you to other resources that will help you to move along that economic mobility line that we talk so much about. The other thing that I would say too, when I think about community organizations and just building community, it's no longer enough for a standalone community organization to do the work in community to create the change that we're talking about. It does require a business and philanthropy and the nonprofits and the public sector. It involves having government present. And one of the things that I think I'm most proud about our organization is that we've made a conscious decision that at the center of all of this will be the voice of the actual community. And that's something quite often, even when we talk about policy and changes and we're going to move this community, we're going to do this, quite often that community voice is left out and or it's silenced. And I always use the example, you would never come into the community that I personally live in and dictate what would happen in my community without allowing my neighbors and I to give voice to that. And yet for some reason in historically under-resourced communities, everyone thinks that it's okay to come into those communities and dishonor the strength and the history of those communities. And so I think when we think about building community, we want to make sure that all of those voices are at the table working together to certainly affect policy, which I think is critically important, and to design what the community can be and should be when all of those entities are working together.
Yes, and to do it from the community. At this point about trust, I think, Tiffany, it's just that's really been a lot. I mean, we talk about trusted relationships here, right? And so there's a difference between someone saying, oh, here's a good opportunity, but you don't know who that person is. You don't know if it's a good lead. And so the relationships have to be founded on trust, but also build trust. And that's how you kind of connect. So, you know, there's very good evidence that people access reproductive healthcare, for example, based on their social networks, but only on trusted social networks. Right? You don't get your reproductive health care from someone because you just were told it. So the difference between information flowing along it and trust and relationships, that's absolutely fascinating. Maurice or Anne, anything on these do events and organizations help? Do they really bridge these relational gaps?
Yes, I think what Tiffany said is actually right. We have started with what we call community conversations. And with those community conversations, we have an opportunity to get the community to weigh in on what's going on in the city. And so is very, very important. And I've been a real stickler with that, because I think that those who are in the room or at the table sometimes put things together without even asking the community, is this good for the community? We just put it together, and then we often wonder, why did it fail? It failed because we didn't have input from the community. So we are really, really working hard to get the community involved in everything that we do here, because it's really important. You know, you're just building stuff in the community that people have no desire to go to. This is not what's going to get them to their next level. So community involvement is very important. And so the community conversations are much needed, and even more in the city of Racine.
Jill, I want to ask you a question about quality of relationship, building on what Tiffany said about a trusted relationship, right? And what kind of relationship we're talking about. And there are various ways of doing network mapping, but the way we kind of did it was to start with the person and then do it outwards from them and ask them. And so what does that tell us about the quality of the relationships they were reporting, right? And it tells us something, right? And how do you think about the extent to which this is a trusted, high-quality relationship? I'm using that term advisedly, but a fit relationship, as opposed to just somebody you met at a community, right? You meet someone at a community conversations event, and then that's it, right? Are you in a relationship with them? So talk a bit about this issue of the strength, quality, and thickness of the relational tie.
Yeah, so folks talked a lot about the people that were closest to them, and a lot of these relationships happened over a long period of time. So people talked about the people that they met in high school, for instance, particularly in communities where there's not a lot of movement, and that those people are still connecting them. I even today connected someone to someone that I went to high school with. And so I think that depth of relationship was really important. And also people talked about working with people that understood their circumstances. We had one individual that was homeless that lived in San Francisco that talked about some resources that she was connected to. And she talked about how the caseworkers kept showing up. They kept showing up for her success and kept showing up to support her even through COVID-19. So I think that there is certainly an importance in the depth and the ability to show up and be consistent for folks. We asked them, you know, were there also people that you don't go to or you do not trust their advice? And some people had to think about that question, but other people had that answer on the tip of their tongue. And so I think that understanding the groups and the organizations that'll show up for you over time is really important. And people trusted people that were closer to them. Trusted family members generally, but then trusted organizations as well that were really dynamic in the community.
It takes time. Someone said that it takes years to build trust and a moment to lose it. And see, one of the aspects of relational building is that it is not going to happen overnight, right? There's not something that will just happen quickly. And Anna, I just wanted to give you a chance to kind of weigh in on this, because I was struck by it going kindergarten to college. That's quite a long time. And now I know that's a policy, that's a financial intervention, but perhaps that's a sort of timeline, you know, we need to be thinking years, decades, in terms of changing these kind of relational patterns, right? There's not going to be an intervention that suddenly builds bridges like tomorrow, even next year. Would you agree with that assessment? It takes a long time. And is that a challenge?
I do think it takes a long time. And I do think that it's a challenge. And I do think that, you know, for us in government, you know, I was just struck by so much that Maurice and Tiffany said. And, you know, I feel like the most important thing that I can do as a public servant, and that we try to do, is to listen, and to listen to people. We sit in various community coalitions all the time that are focused on whether it's criminal justice reform, transit justice, neighborhood groups. You know, unless we really are, you know, listening to folks, hearing kind of what the problems are. And then it's really my job to turn to our fellow departments and the courts and say, what can we do here? You know, what can we do here that's doable for you to implement and will make a real difference in people's lives? And, you know, when you talk about arts institutions, just one thing I wanted to call out, we started something called San Francisco Museums for All, because it could be $100 to take your, you know, spouse and your kids to go see, you know, the Academy of Sciences or the Exploratorium. I know in DC your museums are free, but that is not the case, unfortunately, out here. But now if you show your Medicaid card or your SNAP CalFresh card, you can get in for free. The first summer we did this, 25,000 people used these to go to a museum for our first time. These are our cultural treasures. They should be open for everyone. And the museums, you know, they were so enthusiastic about this program because it really changed who was coming through the door and helped create, you know, the kind of diverse experience, you know, that mm-hmm. they wanted to. So these types of approaches and reforms really benefit everyone, and we really need to focus more on them.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well, I just, as always, I feel like we're just getting started. But I just want to thank all of you for joining us for this conversation. Thank the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and COSAR for their support for this work, which is part of an ongoing project to look seriously at these issues out of the Race, Prosperity and Inclusion Initiative that's led by Camille, who you've heard from at the beginning. So it's just the beginning. But I did want to thank all of you for coming. I want to thank our audience for attending and for all of your questions. And wish you all the best to remain safe and healthy. And hope that the year to come is one of all kinds of improvements, but including in our relationships and networks with each other. So with that, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you all.